You're listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience, a podcast dedicated to helping executives train their sales and marketing teams to optimize growth. Whether you're looking for techniques and strategies or tools and resources, you've come to the right place. Let's accelerate your growth in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome everyone to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. I'm Carlos Noche. And unfortunately, I'm not with my podcast partner, Lisa Schneer, today. She's off working with some of our great clients, but poor Gail's going to have to deal with just me. So for today's topic, everyone, we're going to be talking about the role of sales enablement. How do we integrate it with our sales strategy to drive measurable impact and results for our overall organization? And to help us out with that, we have Gail Behan, Director of Revenue Enablement at LivePerson. Gail has had various roles in sales and enablement, working for SaaS companies, and she brings an extensive experience across strategy, planning, and program development. Gail is also the president of the Revenue Enablement Society. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you, Carlos. So excited to be here.
Happy to have you. All right, Gail. Hey, we always start out with the same question. What is something that you're passionate about that those that may only know you through work or business might be really surprised to know about you?
I am an avid traveler. I love to get on an airplane and go see different parts of the country, different parts of the world, spend time experiencing that culture. And now that my kids are older, I have a 19 and a 25-year-old, I love taking them and getting to have the experience of even showing them places I've been through their eyes.
All right, I'm going to ask you to share, over the last few years, what's one exotic place you've been to that you would recommend?
Turkey. My husband and I did a trip to Greece, and we had a 37-hour stopover in Turkey, and it was 37 hours too short. I would have stayed in a heartbeat. So highly recommend that is a place to go.
We went to South Africa with my sweetheart in November on a safari and the shark cage diving down in Cape Town, the whole thing. And it was an adventure. It was not a vacation. It was work, but it was quite an adventure. So I recommend that on the list if you haven't done it already.
It's high on the list for sure.
After the podcast, I'll give you some recommendations. So Gail, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. How did you get to this place in your career?
I'm very passionate, obviously, about talking about sales enablement. It's why I'm so involved in the Revenue Enablement Society. I came at this profession as a former seller. I started out actually as an account manager, managing programs, and then kind of fell into sales. I was a very reluctant quota crusher. I did not want to be in sales. My dad was a traveling salesman, and I always said, I'm never going to do that. But what I learned about sales, I think a lot of people in the community learn as well, is that if you do it well, it's about consultation. It's about problem solving. It's not about pushing your ideas or your products on people. It's about being the solution that can be really proactive. And I fell in love with that. And so I sold for a really long time. And then I fell into sales leadership because we had a void of sales leadership at my organization and ran teams and grew dramatically our outbound motion specifically within an enterprise product set, and incredibly passionate about giving sellers those skill sets. And honestly, that's how I ended up in enablement, is that as a sales leader, I wanted to focus more on the people than the deals, because I started to realize as a frontline manager, the multiplier effect. If I sat in on a deal, I could help get that deal over the line. But if I coached, if I brought that skill to all of my sellers, we could get a heck of a lot more deals over the line. And ultimately, that's what enablement's doing. It's multiplying the effect of that coaching so that we can take what might be happening on a one-to-one basis in a room with a customer and operationalizing it so it's scalable and repeatable across sales teams. And that's how I ended up here. So passionate about it. Can talk about it all day long.
All right. So for our listeners, hey, how would you explain the role of sales enablement? You know, where does it fit in the whole sales strategy of a company?
It's a great question. I always look at sales enablement as kind of this, like a Venn diagram, this conduit between leadership, the big picture vision of the company, what needs to happen, the product marketing team and product team by extension, what the heck are we selling? Marketing, what are we saying? How are we saying it? And ultimately the customer. What are we hearing back from customers? So if we can take those four groups of information and make it scalable and repeatable for our teams, and we can make it so that our teams understand, how do I leverage this information to build new sales with existing customers? How do I leverage this to open doors with potential customers? How do I leverage this to deepen relationships? That's where enablement really falls in.
So I got a question for you, because it's funny, because a couple of people have asked me this recently. Usually when I see sales enablement, and I say usually, it could be everywhere, it's roles under sales operations, especially if you got a good operations arm. And I've seen it report to the CRO. I've seen it report to marketing. I've seen it report to HR. I love your opinion. Where does sales enablement fit in, or where should it fit in to be the most effective?
That's a great question. And it's evolving, to be very honest with you. We are seeing more and more roles come up that are reporting into sales operations, because it makes sense there, and because we have less of an impact on cost of sale, to be honestly blunt. As long as we have clear access to the CRO and the CCO, operations is fine. It makes sense. But if you have a disjointed organization, it's going to be a challenge for your enabler to get enough information on the true needs of the sales team without having a lot of good contact with the CRO and the CCO. Those are people I talk to all the time, because that helps me understand what the needles that they want to move. And then I go down a level to my frontline managers and understand how I can leverage those team members to actually move those needles. So it's a push-pull. I currently report to sales operations, and I love it. It's actually the first time I'm not reporting to a CRO, and I'm finding it incredibly effective.
And I guess it all depends on the organization, right? Because that's the big thing. In a lot of SaaS companies that have a strong sales ops role, which is an up-and-coming role, I see a lot of number one job function in LinkedIn, I heard. I think it makes sense, right? Because you're kind of in the heartbeat of the business. But the place that I never thought it made sense was like HR, because then I kind of feel like they're just thinking of this as in your job just to educate people. And, you know, and I get a 5-star on my training onboarding program and I'm done. And I think it loses some of that being, like you said, I'm the heartbeat of the business.
We as a community typically do push back against sitting in HR or L&D, because our role is revenue focused. It's why the society, the Sales Enablement Society, evolved to the Revenue Enablement Society last year in October. While all training is enablement, not all enablement is training. And to be honest, most of what we're doing is not in the room with a chalkboard training. That's not the scalable, repeatable model that we work from. And so because our footprint is so much bigger, it makes it harder for us to achieve the outcomes that we need to achieve if we're reporting into HR or L&D or things like that.
So when people think of enablement, and again, maybe this is just my view, so what do I know? I mean, I think of everything from onboarding someone. And I mean, you're right. That could be like, okay, where do I get my laptops and who do I talk to and where's HR to, okay, enable me in my role of sales or just pre-sales or whatever, what have you. But it's also like, hey, how do I become more effective at my job? What are we selling? Who are we selling it to? What are our processes behind it? And when you say revenue enablement, can you help me like, hey, what should be in it and then what should be out of it?
You brought up a couple great points in here. We are not HR onboarding. I'm not going to tell you where to get your laptop or where the bathroom is or what your vacation policy is. I'm not going to go through your comp plan with you. That's not my role. My role is to set you up and successfully on what is the buyer's journey? How do they start engaging with us all the way through renewals and expansion and upsells? So every touch point that you have with that customer falls within the revenue enablement bucket. And again, sales enablement typically, traditionally, was more front side of funnel, top of funnel, right? But if you look at the bow tie model rather than a typical funnel, the bow tie recognizes that the bulk of SaaS revenue, up to 70% of SaaS revenue, happens after the initial sale. If we stop selling them after that initial sale, we are leaving a lot of money on the table, and not just renewal money, but expansion and deepening those relationships. And so having enablement go all the way across that bow tie really gives an organization that flywheel effect with revenue keeps going and building and building and building and building. And so that's the biggest difference, that what revenue enablement is really working on is definitely has a deeper, broader footprint.
All right. So this question, it might be a little self-serving, but let's see how it goes. So I was working years ago with a good friend, Scott Reynolds. He was at VMware. I sat in his office and he had his finger on the pulse of sales, and sales were like, hey, you know, we need help with better negotiating. We need help with better discovery. We need help with, you know, better account management and forecasting. And then he would develop programs or bring in third parties like myself on this, you know, sales methodology side to help with different functions. And ideally, again, this might sound terribly self-serving. I love that model because as an outside consultant, I had a role within it and we partnered to get there, because we all know that rolling out, for example, a sales methodology doesn't start and end with the workshop. In fact, you got to really help drive it with leadership, and it's got to become part of forecasting and coaching, and this could be a whole coaching program. So I don't know, I'm going on too far. The opposite of that is I work with some organizations. They go, oh no, Carlos, we develop our own sales methodology. We train our own. We have our own selling way. And in enablement, we are the kings of that process. And we developed it outside and we know better. Again, as you can tell in my voice, I have a bias. And Gail, I'd love to get your perspective.
I think it's a great question. And I think that the answer is whether you build it yourself or you bring it in from the outside, it has to be the right solution for your organization. And so in both cases, companies tend to get it wrong for the same reasons. If they're buying it from the outside, they don't make it specific enough to their teams. They don't have a good follow-through methodology. So they spend $80,000 to $200,000, but their frontline managers aren't reinforcing it. They're not deal coaching to it. They're not using that nomenclature in every touch point that they have with their team to reinforce it. And so it fails. And then they say the methodology fails. And it's not that the methodology failed. It's that the reinforcement failed. And that's, again, where enablement, whether I'm buying training, and I buy a lot of training, it's still incumbent about myself and my team to put together those reinforcement mechanisms that make it part of our lives daily. If you're building it from inside, what companies tend to do is actually go too specific. They're teaching exactly what needs to happen in every prescriptive moment, but they're not going deep into the skills behind it. And so you have people who only know how to answer a question because it's on an FAQ, but they don't know how to sell to it, how to expand to it. And so when you talk about hard skills versus soft skills, whether you develop either or both internally or externally, there has to be a good marriage to make sure that you are giving your teams the best in breed. And I will say, having done in-house methodologies, it's very hard to do. I think at the very least, bringing a consultant in at some level really helps you as a leadership team get the clarity you need to make sure that you're hitting on both the hard skills and the soft skills, the process and the reasons behind it. So yeah, it's a shameless plug for you, but also for me in enablement, because I bring in people like you. And I think that that value is huge to organizations.
That's very fair. And I try to remind folks, I mean, look, I get them excited in the workshop. I inspire them to get there, and I'll do the coaching on the front end and reinforcement on the back end. But this isn't a one-month program. This isn't a six-month program. This is your DNA going forward. This is the way you engage customers, not only during the sales cycle, to your point on the bow tie, but after the sales cycle. And enablement, you're living and breathing in this account. I need your partnership to make this work. And then you could bring me strategically in where it makes sense, right? So you're not paying me forever. So for example, I just did a coaching workshop and we talked about our 30, 60, 90 day checkpoints. And I go, hey, I'll do these, but in reality, you should be having checkpoints every month forever, because it's constantly changing what's working, what's not, and what do we want to do about it? So I think we're on the same page, which is great, because it is a long-term partnership into this thing. And the other side of it is we really need sales to own it. You and I are facilitating it. They're the tip of the spear in the sales engagement.
100%. I always say, like, I don't have a stick. I only have a carrot. I can only tell you the WIFM, the value in engaging in these learning programs. I can only give you the value of developing yourself and your skills and your talents. Your managers have the stick. They can make you come to my training. I can't make you come. And even if you do come, I can't make you listen. I can't make you take your hands off the keyboard and stop looking at Slack. You have to decide to do that for yourself. So I have to give you a really good carrot that says, listen, if you learn this, you're going to accelerate your deal velocity by up to 10%, because you're going to be able to get ahead of objections. If you do this, you're going to see your ACV go up and your commission, by the way, because you're bundling like products in a way that's logical. Now, do I have your attention? Because you have to want to learn how to do this. And it's hard. I sold for a really long time. The amount of stuff that we throw at our sellers, from processes and our check this box to personas to product complexity, it is really hard. It's hard. And so I appreciate when I say to sellers, like, hey, I need you to take your walk off the floor, take your hands off the keyboard, give me your attention. It's hard to do. And so you've seen a big movement in sales enablement in the last couple of years to much smaller bite-sized content. We're not developing 40-minute e-learning courses with multiple videos for certification. Nobody's taking them. If they are, they hate it. If I'm doing something and it's an e-learning course, it's going to take you 10 minutes. 10 is my promise to you. We offer 1 hour a week live enablement sessions. They are optional. They are recorded. They're very specific topic. So if you want to hear from the voice of the customer, come Tuesday at 4 p.m. If you miss it because you're selling, great, go sell. That's still recorded. You can come back and get it. So I'm very sensitive to, if we do programs that require a stick, that I have 100% buy-in from those frontline managers, then yes, you're willing to hold the stick, hold your people's feet to the fire, and also practice it with them. Because Carlos, to your point, this has to be application-based. When we practice it, that's what makes us learn it. As adults, learners, we don't learn it until we have to apply it. So the practice is the most important part of it.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's a differentiator for me and my partners is the fact that we're still selling, because I think it's really easy for folks to forget how hard it is. And I drag it into the stories. In fact, I was just sharing a story that when I first got into this business, I did this unqualified RFP and the trials and tribulations I went through. And at the end of the story, I could tell you, hey, I won. But the reality was, if I didn't win that one, I had committed so much time and resources that it would have been devastating. So I got lucky that I won at the end. In fact, I would say if I got that same RFP today, I wouldn't do it. It wasn't qualified enough today for me to do it. And it's easier to say when you have enough pipeline. It's harder to do when you don't. But that's why managers need to step in and really be leaders to try to help reps kind of maneuver through all that. You said something, and I wanted to make sure I circle back to it, about the small digestible chunks. So I'm hearing a lot more from organizations. Hey, Carlos. Yeah. The two-day workshop is great, but can we break it up into small little chunks throughout? And I see a lot of value in it as well. In fact, we do this after workshop. It's 2 to 4 minute long. We call it, value selling at work. Lessons that they could literally do on their phones. And then we provide a coaching guide for managers to follow through, like on a weekly basis. So think of it like a 14-week. Hey, this week we're going to learn about objection handling. It's something we already covered, but it's only 3 to 4 minutes to remind you of the content. And then managers, if you want to cover it in your next staff call, here's a 10, 15, 20 minute way of doing so, so that it's effective. My question to you is, I kind of like both, right? So I still see a lot of value in, hey, the deep dive. People love our workshops, whether they're virtual, in person. They really connect on the content. I really make them not only understand it, but practice it. It creates lifelong friends for me. I literally had a person last week that took my workshop 9 years ago go, Carlos, I'm a new VP in a new area. I've never forgotten your workshop. I need your help because I got a whole new team I need you to train. So there's obviously value in it. But by the same token, Gail, I want your advice, because they don't just learn in one class. So how do I piecemeal it? Is there a combination of both, or are we going to go all the way to only piecemealing it in the future?
God, I hope not. I put a post on LinkedIn yesterday about how much I miss in-person training sometimes. I think pre-pandemic, we over-indexed on live, and post-pandemic, we have absolutely over-indexed on virtual, and there's got to be a middle ground. We have to be willing to say to folks, we're going to take you off the floor for 2 days or a day, and we're going to give you pre-work, we're going to give you post-work and reinforcement, but for 1 day, you're going to have to tell your clients, like, I'm off the floor, I'm focusing, and we have to be able to make the investments in doing that in person. And for all those companies who are like, oh, that's expensive, I'm gonna remind them how much office space they're not paying for right now. The reality of doing it in person is absolutely a differentiator, and we have to be willing to do both. And so I'm seeing a lot of companies who are fighting the fight to get budget, to get people back together in person. But as I'm building out programs where I'm bringing in professional trainers, I'm saying like, hey, I'm going to get one day in person. I'm not going to get 2 days in person. So, or I'm going to get one day in person, but I can't get everybody globally. I can only get North America. So I have to be able to scale it for other regions. So there is a more of a hybriding that's happening that is just a necessity. So I hope that we continue to move towards that best hybrid middle ground where we make the investments in our people and the plane tickets and the office space and the food, whatever it takes to make sure that they have the live touch point as well as really good ongoing virtual resources.
I agree 100%. Before COVID, my office was called Delta Airlines. During COVID, everything was in this office, and it was nice because I was super productive and I got to meet the sweetheart that I live with. So that was a good advantage to the whole thing. Nowadays, here's what I've been doing last year, Gail, is like, hey, if you're going to make the investment, the tip of the spear are your managers. Give me your managers for a day or two in person. And let's spend the money on them getting together and really figuring out what's the program, how do I coach to it, and how do I hold my team accountable and get them to come up with this, what I call an action plan to drive success for their teams. Then we'll do virtually the training, but it's managers and their reps together. And I do 4 hour set. If it's a 2 day workshop, what I do is I do 4 half days. So you still got the other half of the day to go make your calls, do whatever you need to do. You don't have any travel associated with it. You just got 4 hours with me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And luckily, I'm knocking on wood, it's been really effective, right? Because the managers have gotten to know me, my jokes, they had a drink with me at the bar afterwards. So very literally are co-facilitating with me in the actual workshop, which is what I need them to do anyway. And it creates a lot better cost effectiveness because, hey, we're not taking all 100 folks and traveling them all around the globe to go do the training. So I'm hoping that stays. Do you have a feeling of this balance between virtual and in-person? You know, do you think we can keep it at this kind of, I don't know what the ratios are, but can we keep that mix going forward?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we'll probably see a rebound where I'm already seeing companies saying, oh, we have to onboard on person again. It's not working. So I think we're going to see that pendulum swing a little bit more to the other side and then it'll come back. And it's, you know, we've been doing that outside of COVID. This pendulum has been swinging for a long time. I think what is the most important thing for me and for the enablement community is that this is outcome driven, no matter what it is. If it's live, if it's virtual, if it's hybrid, it doesn't matter. Do we have clear outcomes that we're moving towards? And are those clearly communicated to our teams? So I start all our live sessions with the WIFM, the what's in it for me, every live session. Here's why you're here. And if there's no WIFM for you, by the way, take off. Because if these WIFMs don't resonate with you, then this isn't the right meeting for you to have. And I think that we, you know, we've lost our way sometimes with that being really tight on the WIFM, especially again in enablement. We get so many people who have requests. Can you come train this? Can you do this? Build this resource. And they've gotten used to me always saying, what's the WIFM? Who is this for? What are they going to get out of it? You're going to ask me to tell someone to take a course, read something, watch a video, whatever it is. If that isn't there, then I'm going to say, okay, then we need to rethink this. And whether it's live or virtual, if we're indexing on that WIFM, indexing on the outcomes, it doesn't matter where we are, what time zone, if we're sitting by the beach, if we're together in a hotel room, we're driving outcomes. And that's what makes the biggest difference for our organizations and for ourselves. We want to. We all want to drive outcomes.
So Gail, this drives me to my next question and great setup. Hey, ultimately, at the end of the day, it's those outcomes that matter. If you want to go Stevie Award in Vegas, the big part about it is, well, what happened? You know, how much did we move the needle in your organization? Any advice for our listeners out there like, hey, how do you measure it and kind of results? Because we got a 10 out of 10 on a training. They loved it. It don't matter if they didn't do anything with it.
I hate vanity metrics more than anything. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. And a lot of metrics that we measure really aren't telling. You know, for example, one of the key metrics that most enablers learn when they're building onboarding programs is time to first sale. Think about that for a minute. We're measuring the time to the first sale. How much handholding does a rep have on their first sale or their second sale or their third sale? Let's be realistic. That's not a telling metric. What I look at is the second month in a row you've hit quota. Not the first one, by the way. When you can do 2 months in a row, then I know you're good to go because you can repeat it. You have the pipeline. You understand how to build from the very beginning to the very end. And so I look at those key metrics. I mean, yes, those are lagging indicators, which are harder to index on. Activity metrics are the best leading indicators, even though usually they're a little bit fluffy. You know, did you come to the training? Did you get certified? Those are all leading. I'm really heavily indexed on the lagging indicators. Like, have we either increased or decreased the number of opportunities, right? Sometimes it's we need fewer ops because we need to be doing a better job at qualifying. Great. Have we changed the average deal size? Average deal size, a really big number. We know if you're discounting too much, your sizes are going to go down. If you're not bundling enough, if you haven't sold high enough, your average deal sizes are smaller. And I can look across a whole set of reps and say, okay, these three people, their average deal size is 10, 12, 18% higher than the other people selling exactly the same thing to exactly the same prospects. How do I move that needle for that lower group? If I'm looking at the length of sales cycle, I don't care how complicated the product you sell is. Time kills all deals. So if I can look at your deal and say, okay, you've had 10 meetings and the people at the top of the board, they're doing this in 8 meetings. Let's go find out what they're doing to get it in 8 instead of in 10. And then all of that reflects in your win rate, right? Your win rate is the reflection of all of the skills that come together to make sure that you can win the deals. So I'm going to look at those 4 and I'm going to say, how can I move the needle on each of those to make sure that we are maximizing the opportunities for our deals?
Kind of speaking of the what's in it for them thing, at ServiceNow, when we started every single workshop, we shared with them a study that they did internally. And it was basically, hey, deals that, you know, your reps are using the value selling framework in their accounts, starting in early stages, you have a 2.7x higher ACV. So why should you listen? Think about how many less deals you got to go close if you can do that. See how much, how quicker you can get to your quota numbers, if only. So that's what we kind of used to kind of get their attention. And I go, these aren't my data. These are your data. I'm just ecstatic about it, right? So, and it isn't another customer. This is you. So that we kind of try to use that data to get there. So we talked about how important managers are. Now, and you alluded to it earlier too. How do you get executive leadership to also buy in? How do you get executive leadership? Because when I say, hey, this has got to be part of our DNA, it can't just be frontline managers. It's got to be top down. So when we do a forecast call, we all need to be kind of using the same language and approach from the top down. How do you get executive leadership to make it part of the DNA of the organization from your perspective?
That is the toughest question. And the answer is prove that it works. Continue, like if you're doing it and you're telling the story, let's say you bring Medic into your organization and you are doing Medic deal reviews and you are seeing those 4 key levers move where our deal sizes are going up, our sales cycles are going down, they're going to speak that language. So I get on my soapbox in enablement about the idea that sales enablement professionals need to speak CRO. We have to speak the language that our CROs and our CCOs and our CEOs resonate with. And that is results, right? They don't care what Medic stands for. They literally don't care. They only care that it's moving those needles. So when we are telling the story, here's this deal, here's how we move the needle through Medic, here's how Medic affected that deal, they'll start using that language. It's not easy. It's hard to get them on board because ultimately that's a place in the weeds they don't need to be. But when they start to see results, they will want to be.
The one little trick I'll share with you, and this is hard to pull off, but at ServiceNow, what we got lucky at doing when we first got started was we trained the whole executive staff. And we asked them, can you use some of this terminology when you go talk about deals and talk about deal strategy? And then as we started rolling out the program across the globe, it was kind of funny. It was like, Kevin's been asking me about this for the last 2 months. This is Kevin's program. Yes, it is. It's not mine. And I shared that story the other day in an account where we didn't get that chance. We literally started with one team and then we worked our way backwards into the leadership and we're trying to work our way backwards into executive leadership. And they go, well, why don't you do that here? I go, I tried. It doesn't always work. But I will tell you, if you can start at the top and get them to buy in, even if it's just using the terms, right? then it's like Medic. It's a great deal inspection tool, but you got to be asking the questions around it. And if you do that, it becomes part of your DNA and it becomes infectious. It's like, oh, he's coming. Carlos is coming. He's going to ask me those questions. You know, at least I know he's going to ask. And I go, at least it gives me some peace of mind that I know what he's going to ask me. He's not going to try to come out of the blue with some new questions. It creates a little bit of, you know, synergy across the group. In enablement, any big mistakes that enablement organizations make today that you go, hey, you know, I've seen this, you know, I'm part of the enablement society. Any advice you got folks to go, it's not mistakes about individual, but hey, look, you know, these are some of the things you got to look out for. Because these are the things that, you know, if we can get these right, you're going to have a much more successful team. Does that make sense?
100%. And I think it is why I'm so involved with the Revenue Enablement Society, and it's about community. As enablers, we are typically a one-person team, maybe two people, maybe three or four if you're super lucky and you're one of the bigger orgs, but your teams are getting smaller. And it is very hard to advance your practice and advance your career in a bubble. And so being part of a community of enablers, being able to reach out and say, hey, I need a framework for this, or I've been challenged to create this training and I'm not exactly sure, or even my gut tells me this, but does that make sense? We need that. We can't walk around our org and ask like, hey, how had you solved this problem before? Because we're typically the only ones having solved it. And so that community is absolutely critical. And especially in the last 18 months where we've seen historic job losses, where enablement teams have been gutted from 10, 12, 15 people to two. If there are two, like we've just seen a lot of job losses, that community is also there to help you define your message and your go-to-market strategy as you go back out as a candidate. And so I'm a huge advocate. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'll talk about this all day long about building community and being part of it, about being part of local chapters for RES, coming to some of the national events and local events, and building your tribe. Because when you have that, you have armor and you have a spear and you have a stick and you have what you need to go to battle within your organization and within your career.
So, Gail, before the podcast, we were talking about this. The last 18 months, maybe 24, it just seems there's been a lot of shakeup in the industry. Enablement's been one of them that's, let's call it slimmed down, and everything's brought up to question. I see that also with SDR organizations. But from an enablement perspective, why do you think that is? And I know we could join the community. What else do you recommend we should do about it?
Funny, I did a whole presentation at our conference last year called The Meteoric Rise and the Crashing Reset of Sales Enablement. And the causes are varied. Part of it was the companies overhired on enablement during the pandemic. They were told like, hey, we heard we need this. And they didn't really understand what the ROI is. We had departments who grew from one person to 12 people. And all of a sudden the company saying, hey, we got a $2 million nut here. Where's the ROI? And really understanding that that ROI is a long tail. We're not, you know, enablement's never going to be a quick fix. And so companies then kind of whiplash the other way as investment dollars have gone down and down and down, and companies are not going to IPO. We've moved from growth at all costs to efficiency at all costs, and enablement is seen as overhead. Our number one goal and the number one goal of this community is to remind people we're not overhead. This is a critical function. If your enablement's done right, your enablement team is sitting in strategy meetings at every turn. If you think of a CEO and they've got a VP of sales and they've got a COO for customer conversations, we are the bridge to both of those, as well as the HR component. We are talking about your people. We don't get into individual deals for the most part. We're talking about the skills, the knowledge, the ability for your people to excel at their jobs. Your sales managers are looking at deals. We're looking at the people behind the deals. And by the way, Gartner tells us it costs $100,000 every time we have to replace a seller. $100,000, really expensive, right? And guess what? The average time in seat for a seller is 18 months and it takes 13 months to get them up to productivity. That's not a winning equation. So what's the best thing you can do as a leader? Invest in your people. And that's where enablement comes in. We are all about investing in your people. We are the ROI for the most expensive thing in your on your balance sheet, which is your people. We will help you figure out the right ones, get the middle of the pack to be better at what they're doing, more productive, and we'll help you understand that, you know, that lower 10%, needs to be removed. That's huge when you think about leadership. And that's where a lot of leaders aren't leveraging their enablement teams. And when they do, they see ROI that they are shocked, like, oh, I never thought about this. Invest in your people, and enablement's the best way to do it.
I also think it's like enabling the top of the pack to be your next leaders. Because if they don't feel like someone's investing in them, they're not going to stay.
Oh, 100%. That great resignation, we're still in a hangover from that. The fact hiring is tightened up doesn't mean that you have people who are going to stay in seat because they want to stay in seat. They're staying because they don't see anything greener out there yet, but they will. The economy will shift again. And we could see another great resignation wave later this year if the world moves in a more positive economic direction.
Well, excellent, Gail. I could talk to you all day, but I got one last big question for you. We call it Acceleration Insights. Hey, what's that one last piece of advice you would share with our listeners so they can be as successful as you are?
I think fall in love with what you do for anybody. Fall in love with it. Be willing to just be a zealot and excited and passionate. And I mean, I'll talk to people on the street corners about enablement. And that's infectious. It gives me armor in the days that are hard. And it gets me excited on the days where I can see some really good wins.
All right, Gail, if our listeners would like to learn more about you or, you know, Revenue Enablement Society, what might be the best way for them to engage with you?
Come knock on my LinkedIn door. I get lots of requests, send me messages. I engage with everybody who sends me a message. I set up time with random strangers all the time just to chit chat and get to know them. I'm a big fan of the ABC, always be connecting. I want to make sure that you are able to find your communities. So start with me on LinkedIn.
Well, Gail, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I thought it was a great conversation. And for everyone, that's the end of our episode. Please check us out at www.b2brevexec.com. You can check us out on your favorite podcast platform, be it Spotify, Google, Apple. If you find us on Apple, hey, give us a 5-star review. We greatly appreciate it. And I'm Carlos Noche. And for everyone, I wish you nothing but the best success.
You've been listening to the B2B Revenue Executive Experience. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in iTunes or your favorite podcast player. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.